I'm Tanzina Vega, talking to you from WAMU Studios in Washington, D.C., and this is the takeaway for May 9th. The fight between House Democrats and the president reaches another level.
We've talked for a long time about approaching a constitutional crisis. We are now in it. We are now in a constitutional crisis.
Are the checks and balances between the branches of government working? Also on the show, a surprisingly strong showing by a far-right party in Spain could have a big impact on Europe as a whole.
Historically, the far-right parties have kind of splintered up into little tiny groups inside the European Parliament, and now they seem to be trying to form a single party or at least two parties.
Plus a look at Trump tariffs starting this week. Let's get going, everyone. The question on the table here in the Capitol, is the system of checks and balances that's written into the United States Constitution working?
There can be no higher stakes than this attempt to arrogate all power to the executive branch away from Congress and, more important, away from the American people. We've talked for a long time about approaching a constitutional crisis. We are now in it. We are now in a constitutional crisis.
House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler speaking to the press on Wednesday after the committee voted to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt for defying a subpoena for the unredacted Mueller report. Members of the GOP took a defiant stance against the push for contempt. Here's Republican Doug Collins, ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, speaking on Wednesday.
Here we are, wasting another valuable week of legislating calendar against the majority's war against the administration.
Just hours before the House panel vote, President Trump exerted executive privilege over the full Mueller report to keep it and its underlying evidence from Congress and the American public. Meanwhile, this week, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin refused a request by Congress for President Trump's tax returns, citing a lack of legitimate legislative purpose. These latest rebukes of congressional oversight by the president again force the question if the president can categorically deny all congressional requests for information or witnesses. Is the system of checks and balances that's written into the United States Constitution even working? We'll dig into some of these big questions with two experts now. I have Victoria Nurse, is a professor of law at Georgetown Law Center, and she's with me here in the studio. Welcome, Victoria.
Thanks for having me.
Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University, and we have him. Keith, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
So, Keith, let's get right to it. How concerned should Americans be about this crisis in our government?
I don't think we should be overly concerned yet. We're still in the early stages of the negotiation between the White House and Congress over just what kind of documents will be provided and what kinds of testimony will be provided. So the rhetoric has ramped up very quickly, but I think we have a ways to go.
Victoria, what do you think? Is the system of oversight working?
Well, I think this president has certainly pushed back harder than other presidents on claiming executive privilege. At least the pattern is pretty clear that he is inviting a crisis in the sense of this will have to be resolved in the courts. So I agree that we're not yet at a crisis, but we have to see what's going to go on in the courts and whether the president will actually accede to a court order, because some of his legal arguments here, frankly, are not very good.
And Victoria, we've seen officials who've been held in contempt for refusing to comply with congressional subpoenas in the past under other administrations. Is this current standoff any different?
The difference in this standoff, this happens every day in Washington, up and down, as Professor Whittington noted, that it's negotiated between the White House and Congress every day for requests. But it rarely goes to court. And then the problem is that it often can take a lot of time. The problem here is that the president is inviting the courts to resolve this dispute in many different places simultaneously. And that's what I see as different between now and Nixon and perhaps earlier.
Keith, let's talk about this assertion of executive privilege. Let's remind us what exactly it means and how it's been used in the past.
So presidents claim executive privilege over documents that they hold and sometimes over witness testimony about conversations that have occurred within the executive branch. Over the course of American history, presidents have claimed fairly broad swaths of things being under executive privilege and say they shouldn't have to share them with either Congress or the courts. That's often been whittled down in practice as Congress has pushed back and gotten hold of some of those documents presidents don't want to share. And so sometimes in court cases where the courts have not been persuaded that these kinds of claims should be as expansive as the administration wants them to be.
And Keith, what is different in President Trump's use of executive privilege here, if anything?
I think part of what's different about Trump is just how sweeping the claims of resistance are. The administration has been particularly bold in saying they don't want to cooperate with any kind of investigations going on in Congress, and as a consequence have tried to throw a blanket of executive privilege over extraordinary numbers of documents, a wide range of witnesses, including people who are outside the government and the executive branch. And that's very unusual for presidents to be that aggressive in staking out this kind of claim. They're also unusual, I think, in just how vague some of the claims of executive privilege are. So these kinds of claims about, for example, in the context of the Mueller report, that the entire report is under executive privilege, all possible documents associated with the report are part of executive privilege. At some point, they're going to have to be much more specific about the very specific kinds of documents, very specific kinds of facts that they want to keep out of public eye.
And Victoria, this is not, as we know, the first time the Trump administration has rebuffed oversight. Are there certain actions by the administration that have stood out to you that have led up to this moment?
Well, the Mueller report is an ongoing story. It seems to be the story that never goes away. But, you know, if I were to bet in terms of where we're going to go, we're going to see the tax case, which is a very strong claim on behalf of the Congress and a very weak claim on behalf of the president, go forward faster than the Mueller report. I agree that the boldness of some of these claims is stunning because, as I said, a number of these arguments are legally quite weak. So it's surprising to see a president raise them. The general wisdom in this town is that Presidents Clinton, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Obama wanted to avoid these clashes because of the public perception, not the law, the public perception. And that rule has been changed. This administration is not following that unwritten rule.
And what are the implications of that? I'd love to ask both you and Keith. What are the implications that the public perception of this is changing?
Well, I think what we're going to have a civics lesson here. It may be that the president is making a political calculation that his base wants him to stand strong against the Congress, that this is a deeply political calculation, has nothing to do with the law, and that his base really does not care about these claims. But we will see this ending up, and I don't think people should be disabused of this. This will go to court in some way, shape, or fashion. The president himself has already preempted aggressively the claim in the tax case. So I think this is chapter one of a book about the crisis. It's not the end of the book on the crisis.
Keith, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think in our current polarized environment, there's a lot of political incentives to dig in, stake out very extreme positions, and refuse to cooperate as much as possible. We also seem to be in an environment in which there's not that much interest in trying to cooperate generally. So the president and Congress don't have a big legislative agenda that they actually want to make progress on. And as a consequence, they can afford to spend their time and resources on these kinds of fights rather than trying to think about how can we get past this particular disagreement in order to focus on the things we have bigger agreements about. I think ultimately the administration is also risking that they're going to lose in court and lose across a range of these kinds of legal battles. And as a consequence, courts are going to wind up defining executive privilege more narrowly than future administrations would like to see. And so there's a really risky strategy to push these legal arguments to their absolute maximum and then try to carry them as far as you possibly can.
I'm speaking with Victoria Nurse and Keith Whittington about their views on the clash between the President of the United States and the Congress. Victoria, let's turn to the Constitution itself, because we hear this constitutional crisis term bandied around. We hear a lot about what the Constitution says, but does the Constitution provide any guidance when it comes to Congress's power to investigate the executive branch?
The Constitution provides Congress with all legislative power, but beyond that, it does not say anything about congressional investigations. Of course, we've had them since George Washington and a defeat of General Arthur St. Clair. So we've had them for a very long time, and we've had some very prominent ones. Teapot Dome was a scandal involving bribery, and then we've had Watergate. But Congress investigates every day because that's the way that they can oversee how the administration, quote unquote, must faithfully execute the law. That's a somewhat misquote of the Constitution. So Congress hands over a lot of power to execute the law to the executive. And this is the only way they can check up on whether the executive is doing a good job. So in 1927, a very famous case, the Supreme Court said, the Congress has broad, far-reaching, sweeping powers of investigation. And even in the McCarthy era, when the court shed some doubt on that extent of how far a committee could treat an individual, they still reaffirmed this far-reaching power because it's an incident to legislation. They cannot exercise either the power of oversight or the power to legislate if they don't know the facts.
Keith, if the executive branch is determined to continue this standoff, to stymie House Democrats in particular, what happens if we end up in a deadlock? What happens next?
Well, at some point, courts will weigh in on this. We increasingly have a situation where Congress wants to take these issues to the courts for further resolution when there are these disagreements over the scope of executive privilege, for example. And so courts are going to get dragged into this. They're going to wind up making some rulings. But in addition, Congress has lots of tools of its own to push back on the administration and make life more difficult for the administration if the administration isn't cooperative. And I presume that Congress will eventually want to make use of some of those tools itself in order to try to put more political pressure on the administration to concede to some of the House demands.
So, Victoria, we heard Representative Jerry Nadler say we're in a constitutional crisis, but you're saying we're not there yet.
Well, we're at the beginning of a story that could lead to one, and it will only be one, in my view, if a court were to order the president to do something like they ordered Nixon to reveal the tapes. And the president declined. That would be a case where the only resolution would be impeachment, which may be why Nancy Pelosi is saying all of these current actions by the president are actually goading them toward impeachment.
Well, and they keep, and the Democrats keep saying that it's on the table, all options are on the table, but there's a little bit of playing coy with that idea.
Well, because they have a legislative agenda and they can't get to it. A cynic might say, well, the president's just doing this to further his presidential ambitions for 2020 and get Congress off its message.
Victoria Nurse is a professor of law at Georgetown Law Center, and Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been over a year since the Trump administration raised tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese goods. China responded by imposing their own tariffs on U.S. goods. An end to the trade war seemed imminent as recently as last month, at least according to the president.
And we'll see if it happens. It's got a very, very good chance of happening. I think that it will be great for both countries.
But this week, everything seemed to fall apart. On Wednesday, President Trump doubled down on existing tariffs on Chinese exports, threatening to impose even higher tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods by this Friday. Joining us now to help us make sense of all this is Tory Newmyer, a national reporter focused on economic policy for The Washington Post. Tory, thanks for coming in for the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been in this trade war for a year, although it feels quite longer. It looked like we might have been close to the solution. Are we back to square one?
I don't think we're quite back to square one. The thought was really as late as last week that we were in the final lap here. The Trump administration had a trade delegation over in Beijing last week. The Chinese were going to send a 100-person strong team back to Washington this week. And we thought we were sort of dotting I's and crossing T's here.
And then what happened?
It all sort of fell apart at the end of last week. And what we've learned is that U.S. Trade Representative Bob Lighthizer reported back to the president after those meetings in Beijing, and he said, wait a second, the Chinese are at the last minute here seeming to change the terms of the debate. They are making new demands and retracting some of the concessions that we thought they had already agreed to.
Now, how were things going before Trump threatened additional tariffs? Was it just the Chinese who started changing the game here, or the president also started changing the game, didn't he?
I think the reporting about this has been pretty reliable, and I think we can reach the conclusion with some confidence that it really was the Chinese here that changed the terms of the debate. in these negotiations. And what they did was they had agreed to enshrine the concessions they had made to make some of these structural reforms that the Americans had been demanding in law. And what they came back to the Trump team with at the end of last week was new terms. They said, in fact, we are not going to enshrine these in law. That would infringe on our sovereignty, and it would be a bureaucratic process that we don't want to engage in. And in fact, we're not going to do that. And the way Lighthizer, who is a veteran of these negotiations with the Chinese, read that was, this is kind of a bad faith move, and they're looking for wiggle room so that after this thing is signed, they can walk away from the commitments they've made and not actually abide by the terms of this new trade agreement. And that is how he briefed President Trump, and Trump was infuriated and sent a couple of tweets on Sunday that said, we are not near the finish line, essentially, and I'm going to impose these new tariffs if the Chinese don't come back to where we thought they were. And that's what set in motion the sort of downward spiral that we've been tracing all week.
Tory, do you expect Trump's tariffs to actually go into effect on Friday, which is tomorrow?
Yes, I do. Okay. I'm willing to go there.
You heard it here first, folks. Yeah,
exactly. But and that's just because of the way the tone of this is taken over the course of this week. I mean, both sides seem really dug in. There seems to be a lot of bad juju on both sides. But there is an interesting detail that we learned yesterday when the Trump administration published the official notice that they were actually going to go through with this tariff escalation on Friday. And that is, they said these tariffs are going to be imposed on only on goods that ship after the deadline kicks in. So that any boats that are on the water are ready, carrying goods to American ports, are not going to be subject to these tariffs. And that is a kind of carve-out that we have not seen them make before in any of these tariff escalations. And I think the pretty clear conclusion you can draw from that is the trade team is trying to build in a little bit more wiggle room if they don't make a breakthrough in the marathon talks that are kicking off today and will conclude tomorrow, so that they've got some extra days on the back end here to try to work their way out of this escalation.
China has also promised to retaliate. Do we know what that might look like? Is that also in the form of more tariffs?
We don't know what it looks like yet. They have said they are going to detail exactly what they are going to do. The problem is, because they import so much less from us than we do from them, they're going to run out of American goods to tariff. So they can keep jacking up the level of the duties they're imposing on American imports. But at some point, they're going to have to resort to some non-tariff measures. And that's, you know, that's potentially scary because it could be a lot of different things.
So a lot of the president's rhetoric around this is often that the U.S. is losing and we want to strengthen the U.S.'s trade policy, particularly with China. But we often forget about the fact that these trade policies and these trade wars also affect you and I, consumers, everyday folks. Will we start to feel an effect if this continues to escalate?
Yes, and we already have, in ways that maybe you haven't noticed. But the way the Trump administration has structured these tariffs so far, they impose them on what they call intermediate goods. I mean, these are circuit boards and computer chips, auto parts, stuff that form finished goods so that you aren't actually seeing them when you go to buy a car or a handbag or Christmas lights. As we work through the product list, and they need to impose these taxes on a different category of Chinese imports, all they're left with now at this point really are consumer goods. So if he goes through with what he's threatened, you're going to see higher prices on food that we import, on clothes that you buy at Walmart and Target, and consumers really are going to notice some differences on the prices of the goods they're buying.
Could that ultimately pressure the administration to change course?
Absolutely, if it affects public sentiment. I think the more immediate barometer for the president, the thing that he looks at all the time, is the health of the stock market. And so far, the reaction there has really been pretty muted. We've seen a 2.2% decline in the stock market over the first three trading days of this week, which is really pretty moderate when you consider the market seems to have priced in a deal getting done. They think this is going to happen. And the estimates about how far We could see the stock market slide if this really falls apart and investors internalize that this isn't happening anytime soon, range from anywhere to 10 to 20%. That'd be a serious dip, would certainly catch the president's attention and might reset the debate here and encourage him to strike a deal, even if it's not the one he originally wanted.
Well, we know that the Chinese envoy is meeting in Washington now, and we'll be paying close attention to that. Tory Newmyer is a national reporter focused on economic policy for The Washington Post. Tory, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Voters across the European Union will go to the polls in just a few weeks to elect more than 700 members to the European Parliament. The elections are a test of whether the far-right populist and nationalist ideas that we've seen in the United States and around the world will continue to grow in popularity. And now many are looking to Spain's general election held at the end of April as a bellwether of the EU vote. Even though Spain's Socialist Party still got the most votes, the elections were also a relatively strong showing for the country's far-right movement. The nationalist Vox Party got 10% of the vote.
What's significant is the fact that there hasn't been a far-right party in Spain since the end of the Franco dictatorship in the 1970s.
Anne Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and a columnist for The Washington Post, and she says the looming question is whether far-right leaders across Europe will capitalize on the Spanish elections to put their stamp on continent-wide policies.
People thought that Spain was somehow immune to the far-right, you know, that they'd had fascism, they'd had dictatorship, and they were just wary of the issues of Francoism and the symbols of Francoism coming back. But the success of Vox, which is still, it's only 10%, I don't want to exaggerate it, but it is proof that the memory of Franco and the kind of taboo has been lost.
Now let's talk a little bit about the party itself. This is a new and emerging party, I understand. And what are the parameters of their ideology?
It's interesting. In the spectrum of the European far right, it's a little different from some of the others. It has emerged partly as a reaction to, you may remember, the Catalan separatist crisis of some months ago. And the party, it wants to kind of reaffirm Spain and Spanish nationalism and the unity of the nation. So that's a specific Spanish issue. It's also an anti-feminist party, or maybe a feminist skeptic party. And it's brought up several issues that will be familiar to Americans who know how the Christian right works in this country. And that's a little bit more unusual in Europe, to have a party that's very specifically focused on those kinds of issues. It's a kind of backlash to social liberalism. Like other far-right parties, it is anti-immigration, or more specifically anti-Muslim immigration, anti-illegal immigration, which actually until now has not been thought to be a huge issue in Spain. And also it did something interesting, which is it picked up on some issues that nobody really knew mattered, like gun rights, which I think they've borrowed from the United States. And it matters to a very tiny number of vocal Spaniards, and, you know, support for some traditional sports like bullfighting, which is also, some people now question whether it's humane. So they kind of put together a package of issues in an interesting way. I mean, it used to be that parties had single ideologies, but Vox is really a composite of several things that they saw as being underrated or underrepresented in Spain.
You mentioned the Catalan separatist movement, which is something that for many, many, many decades has been sort of emerging. But it is obviously something that's of real importance now. Is Vox, does it have a demographic profile? Does it have a geographic profile? Because there are some in Catalonia who would say Catalonia should be separate, but yet there are others who think that it should be, you know, continue to be part of Spain. And does Vox have roots in that region?
So Catalonia has a kind of specific set of politics and political parties, and I don't think Vox had a huge echo there. Its most important echo and its most important kind of demographic is younger men. I think I saw a statistic between 35 and 45. Younger men are its biggest numbers. And these are often people who would have been affected by the financial crisis of a decade ago, and who, although they may be back in work now, Spanish economy is now growing, may still harbor resentment or feel loss over that. And as I mentioned before, this is a party that takes very specifically, it takes aim at Spanish feminism, at some of the, you know, there's a particular law on domestic violence that the party dislikes, and it is seeking to appeal to younger men. And I mean, some of the imagery, you know, is very, you know, there's a Make Spain Great Again video that was quite notorious.
Sabrás que estás logrando hacer a España grande otra vez.
The party leaders had themselves filmed on horseback, riding across the southern Spain in a reenactment of the Reconquista, you know, the Spanish, when the Spanish pushed back the Muslims out of southern Spain. So there is a kind of masculine imagery that they've used very successfully.
How effective is Vox? And what I mean by that is, how much are they resonating with the Spaniards right now?
We just had an election and they won 10%. And having gone from 0 to 10%, that was a big change. You know, they didn't, party that didn't exist 3 years ago at the time of the last parliamentary election is now in parliament. They had enormous amount of success online. Their Twitter following, their Instagram following was all much bigger and more enthusiastic than almost any other party in Spain. And so I think people were expecting them to do even better than that. But what looks like what happened is that their enthusiasm, their loudness, their sometimes their aggressive tactics, their use of sometimes very angry language also seems to have sparked a backlash. And so paradoxically, the party that seems to have benefited the most from Vox being in the election is the Spanish center left. It gained more votes. The center left prime minister will now stay in power. In a way, it was almost as if the emergence of this far-right party scared others kind of back into the center, back towards a party that's talking about, you know, economic issues and not so much these kind of identity issues that Vox was focusing on. So it clearly speaks to some people. It's a new party. It's got a lot of enthusiastic supporters, but it also caused others to think twice and think maybe actually what they wanted was something much more centrist and familiar.
We know that EU parliamentary elections are coming up in a couple of weeks. Is Vox and or other far-right parties trying to coordinate ahead of these elections?
Yes, we see them coordinating online. I mean, there's absolutely no question they're doing that. And that's coming both from the parties, but also from what I would call the international alt-right. So these are kind of online activists, some organized and coordinated in ways that people who do analytics of these things have been following, some just, some just voluntary and some spontaneous. But in addition to that, yeah, the far-right leaders of Italy and of France, the Hungarian prime minister, have been meeting. They've been coordinating. They've been talking about working together after the elections. Historically, the far-right parties have kind of splintered up into little tiny groups inside the European Parliament, and now they seem to be trying to form a single party or at least two parties. You know, the difficulty will be for them finding a common agenda. Some of them are very pro-Russian. Some of them, like the Poles, for example, are very anti-Russian. They have different emphases depending on where they're from. I mean, the obsession with Muslim immigration in southern Europe or in France or Germany has a weird echo in Eastern Europe where there aren't any Muslims. So they don't have exactly the same issues everywhere. But what they're finding is these, for the first time, kind of themes. And mostly these themes are to do not with economics, but with identity.
Anne Applebaum is a columnist for The Washington Post and a professor of practice at the London School of Economics. Anne, thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Special thanks to the folks at WAMU in Washington, D.C. for hosting us today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.